This is Midday on WNYC. I'm Rebecca Carroll. This past March marked the 15th anniversary of the Bush administration's invasion of Iraq. President Bush had claimed that Saddam Hussein was stockpiling weapons of mass destruction, a claim some still press even now, though the CIA and others have found that Iraq's WMD capacity was destroyed in 1991. After the 9/11 attacks, few American journalists challenged the Bush administration claims. Among the few who did investigate were Jonathan Landay, Warren Strobel, John Walcott, and Joe Galloway at Knight Ridder Newspapers. Director Rob Reiner tells their story in his new movie, Shock and Awe. It will be available exclusively on DirecTV starting on June 14th and in theaters on July 13th. And I'm very pleased it brings Rob Reiner to our show. Oh, welcome.
Thanks, Rebecca. Thanks for having me.
So why this movie now?
Well, it turns out that it resonates in a big way with what's going on with the American press at this point. I mean, there's a line in the movie where a character I play in, John Walcott, who is the editor of the Knight Ridder journalist, and he says, when the government says something, you only have one question to ask. Is it true? And that is the purview of the journalist. And if they don't pursue that truth, we can see what'll happen. We can go to war based on lies. And right now, the truth is under attack.
I think that it's really important to look at, you know, how timely it turns out that this film is, but also what it means to pursue the truth. And in this, particularly in this era where the truth is being so blurred on purpose.
Yes. And that's the scary part. In the past, you've always had administrations, pushing propaganda, whether to sell a particular policy or a rationale to go to war. But this is the first time in American history where we have a president backed up by essentially state-run television, where you have, you know, Fox and Breitbart and Sinclair and even Alex Jones, so that the people who are supporters of the president, who listen to those outlets, are fed a daily a menu of lies, and they continue to be lied to. So they the thinking is cemented in a certain way. So now you have the mainstream, you have the New York Times, Washington Post, and, you know, NPR, and ABC, NBC, and CBS. They have to work extra hard to get people to understand what the truth is, because at the end of the day, it's all about whether or not we're going to hold this president accountable for what he did. And what he has done is far more egregious than anything we saw in either Iran-Contra or Watergate. This is about the sovereignty of American democracy and whether or not our 241 years of self-rule will survive. And so we have to be extra vigilant now. And the free and independent press is really a pillar of a democracy, and it has to work extra hard right now.
So returning to the film, what would you say specifically the Knight Ridder journalists got right? How did they pursue the truth in the right way?
They got it all right. They debunked the idea that Saddam Hussein was in any way involved in 9/11, that he had no connection to Al-Qaeda, that the aluminum tubes that they said were equipped to enrich uranium were not, that there was no clear evidence of weapons of mass destruction. They got it all right, and they published articles about all of this. Unfortunately, the Bush administration never responded to them and didn't give them any oxygen, and they were more than happy to feed the mainstream press the propaganda that they wanted that they put out there. And at the time, people were caught up in what happened after 9/11. There was a patriotism that ran through the country, and nobody wanted to question the administration, and nobody held their feet to the fire. And the press right now is doing a good job of trying to unearth the truth, but we've got a president who was not held accountable during the election cycle, and he got a free ride, and now we're stuck with somebody who is very good at spreading false information and what the Soviets and now the Russians call active measures, a disinformation campaign.
Do you think on any level that Trump feels like he is telling the truth?
You know, it's hard to know what he thinks and what he doesn't think, because there's something sociopathic about him. There's a pathological lying. We don't know if he's ignorant at times, if he's outright lying, knowing he's lying, if he believes his own lies. But at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. All that matters is that they're lies and that the press has to call them out for what they are. And it's almost impossible to keep up with it, because he lies continually all day long about virtually anything, big and small.
You said that the Knight Ritter journalists got everything right. Why did so many other American journalists get it wrong?
Because, like I say, they were caught up in patriotism and they were fed a certain line. They didn't want... Listen, a lot of people believed that when Colin Powell went in front of the United Nations and made the case, the final, what we call the closer, people believed him. He had a lot of credibility, and people believed that if Colin Powell is saying it, it has to be true. But that was the end result of a continuous campaign to feed the media lies. And people, they wanted access. They wanted to maintain access. And the reason I think that the Knight Ritter guys were so successful is that their sources were lower level. They didn't, they talked to upper level people, but they also talked to a lot of these on the ground, lower level people who could give them the truth and who were real patriots and saying, they didn't like seeing what happened. They didn't like seeing us marching to war based on a country that had hadn't attacked us. And they came forward. So they had these great sources, and they put the stories out there. But unfortunately, it wasn't picked up.
And why was making this film so personal or important for you?
For me, it was very personal in that I was of draft age during the Vietnam War. I never thought in my lifetime that I would see our country, who were the good guys after World War II, go to war based on lies, twice, Vietnam and then Iraq. And I saw the lies that were being spread, and we were going to war. And I said, I can't believe this is happening twice in my lifetime.
Is there ever a reason to go to war?
If you're attacked, you have to defend yourself. There's no question about it. And so you do have to defend yourself. But certainly you don't go to war for your hegemony. You know, you don't do that just to try to force people into democracy at the point of a gun. It doesn't work.
I mean, I think of that in terms of, generationally speaking, and, you know, we all have the benefit of the years that we've lived and the wisdom that we have. But I think as a parent of a teenage, almost teenage son, and trying to decipher, you know, reasons to go to war, reasons that we believe or don't believe the president, reasons that journalists pursue the truth. How do we find that line, that narrative to stay on the right track?
It's a great question, and it requires a lot of work and diligence by citizens. You have to, first of all, identify news sources that are credible. They're not always going to get it right, but even the credible news sources make mistakes, but then they will hopefully retract. But then you have to look at other sources and cross-reference and then make a decision for yourself. But you do have... citizenship requires work, you know. The democracy requires work.
I'm speaking with Rob Reiner, whose latest film is Shock and Awe. This is a very political film.
Yes.
Right? What are the challenges there? I mean, I think as somebody who watches documentary and drama alike and feels that there's a lot, and also writes nonfiction and fiction and feels that there's a lot to be garnered from both, what are the challenges and how do you approach it as a director and actor and keep their humor and also seriousness.
This is a blue book. This is an essay question you've given here. How much time do I have to answer? I think for me, it depends on the film you're making. I mean, some films are fantasy. Some films are comedy. There are different rules and grammar for, let's say, When Harry Met Sally and Misery. When you're making a film that is based on truth and what actually happened, like I did with Ghost of Mississippi and what I'm doing here with Shock and Awe, I feel you have a responsibility to get it right, because I know so many people get their history through movies. You want to make sure that if they watch your movie and they want to know the story of how we got into Iraq and the story of these journalists, you can watch this movie and feel confident that you're being told what actually happened. And to that end, I had the journalists themselves as not only consultants, but they were on the set all the time telling us, yes, this happened, yet no, that didn't happen. So it's difficult when you're doing a piece of entertainment, because you also want to make it compelling and dramatic and engaging. And so you have to make that the balance and make choices. But I never, ever want to put something out there that just makes something up, because that to me is you're abrogating your responsibility as
and
a filmmaker.
And what about casting? I mean, obviously, you know, we're in this time where we're talking a lot about diversity in film, and, you know, obviously you're not going to cast the two main journalists as Hispanic or Black or what, because that would be making something up, right?
Yes.
But there, I wonder, because of course I'm watching it and I'm saying, well, oh, it's another film with a bunch of white guys.
And it is. There's no getting around it. Those are the people. And as much as I, you know, pushing diversity in everything I do, I can't, I mean, I made a picture before that, LBJ. And there literally were no Black people in the Congress, in either the House or the Senate. So you can't make that up. You can't pretend that there are. I mean, that is history, you know, and the whole movie is about pushing civil rights and about voting rights. And so you have to be accurate with it and I guess show the challenge that he had with so many people who are racist, we still have today. More racism than we even want to think about. But you have to be accurate.
What was it? What did you get everybody who you wanted in the film?
Yes.
I mean, apart from the one.
Yes,
that you
apart
had to...
from me. I was. the part that I played was supposed to be played by Alec Baldwin. And then 2 days before he was supposed to shoot, and I had already been shooting with everybody else for a week, he dropped out. So I scrambled around, and my wife actually suggested that I play the part. And I don't really like acting and directing, but I didn't really have much of a choice. And the one direction she gave me, because I'm playing a guy named John Walcott, she said to me, try to be less Jewish. So I tried to do it. I don't know if I succeeded in that.
Well, you're great in the role. And
oh,
it's and there's a lot of chemistry, I felt, it, you know, within the performances and the actors. How did it feel on set?
It did. It felt tremendous. Woody Harrelson and James Marsden, who plays Warren Strobel, they had a great chemistry together. They ad-libbed a lot of stuff together because by the real Warren Strobel and Jonathan Land, they told us they would banter back and forth about things. So we had a lot of that, and it was a good experience, really good experience.
It's pretty intense to see the footage of 9/11 still. It's remarkable that it's still so raw.
And I think that's the point.
Of course, yes.
The point is that it is so raw and it is still so powerful. You know, all these years later, that's what you can see how journalists got wrapped up in the patriotism of that.
And so viewers are going to have their memories brought up, and the recollections will differ. Do you feel like the movie and a movie such as Shock and Awe can shape perceptions of what happened and sort of intersect with the memories?
Well, I think they can, and I think what hopefully it will do, it's a cautionary tale for sure, and I think what it hopefully can do is tell people what we state right at the beginning of the film. There's a quote by Bill Moyers which talks about a democracy is dependent on a free and independent press, that how critical that is, especially in this time, how critical that is and how we have to be vigilant and making sure that we push very hard for the truth to come out.
I'm Rebecca Carroll, and I'm speaking with director Rob Reiner about his new film, Shock and Awe. I'm Rebecca Carroll, and this is Midday. I'm speaking with director Rob Reiner about his new film, Shock and Awe. What do you feel like the appetite is like for a film like this in Hollywood right now?
Well, I don't know about Hollywood, but I do know that, you know, we've had a number of screenings. We had a screening actually in Munich, and we got a standing ovation. I do think there is some, desire for a film like this because it seems to hit the zeitgeist right now. This is a small independent film, but hopefully people will find it on DirecTV or in the theaters, and it will resonate, hopefully.
And it's interesting that I saw that response from Munich, that a foreign audience would take to the film. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that people outside the United States saw what was happening when we decided to go into Iraq. I mean, French foreign ambassador spoke out against it in the UN, and people were very much aware of what the United States was doing. They didn't understand why they would do it, but they could see clearly they wanted to go to Iraq based on no reasonable rationale, and they were totally with it. I mean, and they were thrilled that an American filmmaker would make a film that told the truth of how we got into Iraq.
And I wonder, too, we were talking earlier about how timely the film is and given the presidency, the Trump presidency now, and, you know, I have this sense that the rest of the world is looking at us like we're just idiots.
Well,
right?
They are. I mean, every time I go anywhere outside of America, people say, what the heck is going on with you people? I mean, here we are for the first time in our history, and certainly the allies that we've developed after the Second World War, the creation of NATO, the European Union, our oldest allies, United Kingdom and Canada and Mexico, you have a president that is trampling on these allies. And Germany, they're going, he's at the G7 summit, and he's angry at the people that have been supportive of the United States and have helped the United States for all these years. And he's in bed with Putin and people like Duterte and Erdogan. He envisions himself as a strong man, and I think he's got oligarch envy. I mean, he looks at somebody like Putin and he sees a guy who basically gets a cut of every single business that runs through that country, and that's what he wants. He wants to be one of those guys, and he doesn't care about democracy. He doesn't care about the rule of law. He doesn't care about a free press. He calls it the enemy of the people, and these are all autocratic ideas. And so that's who is our president right now, and we've got to fight. We've got to fight very hard because we're used to democracy. We're the oldest democracy on the planet, but it can go away. Make no mistake, it can go away if we're not vigilant, we don't fight.
Trump also claims he never supported the war in Iraq, but
that's not true. That's a lie. That's a lie.
Voicing support of it in 2002 and 2003.
Yeah.
Do you feel like a dramatic work can have a greater impact than the raw footage of the events in that, especially when we're talking about Trump, who we have on tape saying this about Iraq, we have on tape calling women terrible things. All of these things, we have the nonfiction version.
Yes.
So in some ways, is the dramatic version maybe more hopeful?
It might be. You don't know. But I can say that all of those things that we have on tape on Trump were really not pushed to the forefront during the campaign. We're hearing about it now, and the journalists are doing their hard work at trying to unearth, the truth. But during the campaign, these things didn't come out. I mean, I'll give you an example. If, let's say, you heard of a guy running for the presidency of the United States who fraudulently stole people's life savings through a fake university and was sued in a class action suit, lost the suit, had to pay $25 million to people who he had defrauded, and took the money from other people, funneled it through his own foundation, and gave it to them. And that was the main story that you heard about Donald Trump. It might be a little bit different. I mean, I'm not talking about, you know, grabbing women by their private parts or, you know, cheating on his wife or any of that. I'm talking about just that. But it only came up briefly by Marco Rubio, and then it was just, it went the way of everything else.
And or his blatantly racist past.
Yes.
Taking out a full page in the New York Times against the five youth in New York City, the Central Park Five.
You're exactly right, but I want to say something about that, because he did launch his campaign on birtherism, calling Barack Obama an illegitimate president. And that did make the racism that exists in this country bubble up to the surface in a big way. But that's something he wanted to do, because the people that he was trying to get him elected were people, many of them were people who were angry at the fact that we had the first African-American president and were reacting to that and saying, that's not our country. So I'm talking about those same people who were, money was taken from, the white working class, whatever they say, those people. And yes, but the racism, of course, would galvanize our side of the table. With our side of the table, it would energize us to want to go to the polls, but it wouldn't suppress his side. His side would be emboldened by that.
And we have seen it very clearly.
Yes.
It has been.
Yeah, and he continues to stoke the racist flames.
You said earlier, just now, that democracy, we're used to democracy, but it can go away.
Yes.
Who are the keepers of democracy? Who can we look towards?
Okay, so the keepers of democracy, there are pillars. One of them is the free press. That is under attack, as we say, you know, called fake news, enemy of the people. The other is the wonderful design that our founding fathers had of checks and balances. That is not there. The Congress is not doing their duty and constitutional duty of providing checks right now. The Republican Party is gone in, you know, pushed all in on Trump and Trumpism. The third thing is the courts. And the courts are holding right now. So hopefully Bob Mueller will do his investigation, and the courts will uphold the rule of law, because the rule of law, make no mistake, is also under attack. Every single day, Rudy Giuliani or Trump, through his tweets, goes out and attacks the Justice Department, the FBI, the intelligence community, and it's all fake news, no collusion, witch hunt. And those are the words you hear, and those words are pushed out to his base, and they cement their thinking. So we have these institutions, and right now the Justice Department is holding, but, you know, let's see what happens.
I'm speaking with Rob Reiner about his new film, Shock and Awe, which you also co-wrote. Is that right?
Well, Joey Hartstone wrote the screenplay. I did a lot of writing, which I do on all the films I work on, but Joey Hartstone.
And so what did it feel like as we're talking about sort of going deep into democracy and the current Trump presidency? What did it feel like going deep back into the Bush administration?
Well, I mean, it was a frightening time for us who knew what this war in Iraq was going to foster. You know, we have a line in the film where one of the characters talks about how you can see your child running into the street and you feel helpless to save him from the oncoming truck. And that's the way a lot of us felt looking at what we knew would be unleashed if we went into Iraq and removed Saddam Hussein. And it always confused me, because the people who designed the war, the, you know, Wolfowitz and Pearl and Doug Feith and people in the administration, they knew, or at least I thought they knew, that if you look at your history, you're going to know that there has been a schism between the Muslim community, between Shia and Sunni, that it goes back 1,400 years, and a fight over who the natural heir to Muhammad would be, and that schism would be opened up if you took the strongman out of Iraq. So we knew what was going to happened, and it also, you know, led to the formation of ISIS. And so it was always astounding to me, the thought that you could go in there, and this was something that was written up in the Project for the New American Century, which came out long before the invasion of Iraq, and the thought of going into Iraq was a thought about before 9/11, long before 9/11. They were discussing going into Iraq the day after 9/11, and that made no sense. The idea that you could just magically somehow place a Western-style democracy in the Middle East that would proliferate magically and then protect Israel ultimately was like crazy thinking, you know? I mean, I used to make the joke all the time, but I would say, didn't any of these guys see Lawrence of Arabia? I mean, these are arbitrary countries that were formed after the First World War by the French and the British. They just carved up the territory. So it wasn't like these were actual countries that had any kind of roots in democracy. They had only roots in tribalism.
And so what was the timeline sort of the making of the film, and where did you start, and how did it intersect with the election?
Right. Well, I wanted to make the film right after the invasion. I was trying to find any way to talk about that, because a lot of good films about Iraq came out. I mean, there was the one by
Zero Dark 30.
Well, that was later. That was about getting Osama bin Laden. Right. But the one that Hurt Locker.
Yes, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah,
actually.
Which won an Oscar and a very good film. But that was all about people in Iraq and dealing with the very dangerous things of having to, undo IEDs. This was about how we got in there. Nobody had made a film about how did this happen? How did we wind up going there? And I wanted to do it right away. I didn't know how to approach it. I had an idea of doing it as a satire, you know, like a Dr. Strangelove kind of thing. And I couldn't get a script that I liked. Then I tried another way to go, and that didn't work. And then I saw a documentary by Bill Moyers, and it was about these four journalists at Knight Ridder. And I went, that's my way into this. And so I started developing it that way.
And so how much from that point, you've been talking about it, and obviously you're quite politically involved and savvy and whatnot, but for something like this, and you want to make sure that it's true, and you just have to submerse yourself,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you submerse yourself, and then how much do the cast members, is it a group sort of project?
Yes, it is. I mean, I like I say, I was very lucky in that we had the four journalists who wrote and published these stories with us all the way. They were with us through the development of the script. They were on set with us when we were shooting. And so we had access to, you know, the horse's mouth. I mean, we're there all the time with them.
And did you learn things that surprised you?
Or
freaked you out?
I learned a couple of things. One, and I still can't say it to this day because they're protected sources, but I did, we have sources in the film, which we don't identify except for vaguely, you know, U.S. official or intelligence analyst or something like that. But I was able to figure out who two of them were, and I'm not going to say who they were, but that was to me. And when I did, they didn't, you know, it was one of those Woodward and Bernstein moments. I'll count to 10. If you don't say anything, I'll know I got it right. And I did get them right, but I won't say who they are.
Did you talk with any other sort of media outlets? But you had the journalists on set and with the script. But did you talk with other folks outside of that? No.
No, I didn't, because the mainstream media got it all wrong. The New York Times, the Washington Post, NBC, CBS, ABC, CNN, everybody got it wrong. So I wanted to know, how did these guys get it right?
Right.
What did they do? And that what they told me that is that they had lower level sources. They had people who were willing to go on record and to talk about it.
And were those reporters, were they ever sort of honored?
John Walcott was after that, but they never got the recognition. I mean, you know, Woodward and Bernstein got a Pulitzer for, you know, Watergate, but they brought down a president. These guys never got their due because they weren't successful. I mean, their job was not to try to stop the war. Their job was to get the truth out and hopefully, people would clamor enough to stop the war. So the war went on and they never got their due.
Why do you think?
Because they never, the Bush administration was smart enough not to give them any oxygen. They never responded to any of their stories, and they just let it be. And so it's unfortunate, but hopefully what they do is they tell you what good journalism is all about and what you have to do in order to try to get to the truth. And like I say, the to me, the most important line in the film is the character I play. He says, if the government says something, you have only one question to ask, is it true?
And I will say that truth still remains somewhat uncertain.
Well, it only is uncertain because the people who are executing policy are making it uncertain. They know the truth, but they're choosing maybe not to say it or to obfuscate it or to out and out lie because they want to effectuate the policy that they want.
So it's trickier for everyone now.
It
right?
is.
It's trickier
way
for journalists.
Hard.
It's trickier for citizens
yes.
to sort of find that truth and stand beside
yes.
behind it and take a stand.
Yeah, tough time. we're living in a very, very tough time.
I also, I know we're going to run out of time in a little bit, but as somebody who sort of toggles between journalism and opinion writing and this sort of notion of objectivity versus bias or whatnot, are we storytellers in the sense other than purely factual? Because, you know,
well,
the truth, as we talk about what it means to tell the truth and recollections and memory, you know, experiences are different.
Yes, experiences are different. There's no way that you can't bring your life experience to the work you write. That doesn't mean you can't be objective or try to be factual. But it also doesn't mean that there's a moral equivalence to everything. Not everything has two sides. You don't have to have equal voices on both sides. I mean, you know, how often do we have to say there isn't two sides to climate change? You know, there's one side, and then, you know, if you want to give voice to the deniers, give them a minute, but you don't give them 50% of the time. That's the difference. And to me, to be objective about climate change, then give 90% of the time to the climate change believers and 10% to the deniers, and then you're being objective.
Thank you so much for joining me. I'm Rebecca Carroll, and I've been speaking with director Rob Reiner about his new film, Shock and Awe. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.